On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, it's our opening day recap. The 2026 regular season has begun, and the rookies stole the show. We talk about those kids playing ball. We talk about the ABS challenge system in action, and we give you an extra special edition of the good, the bad, the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that believes every day should be opening day. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. That was fun.
Let's do it again. I enjoyed watching Major League Baseball games again. As someone who swears off spring training to an extreme degree, it was so comforting to just throw on the old MLB TV and let it wash over me. For, I guess, 12 hours, basically. It was, there were some gaps there. The game times were staggered in kind of a strange fashion. And I know there are still six teams waiting to start their season, which breaks my heart. But my goodness, did this opening day give us a lot to talk about. And we are going to begin with the kids. That's our opener.
Or so years ago, Major League Baseball released a promotional campaign revolving around the slogan, "Let the kids play." They did that yesterday. The kids very much played. Rookies were the story of the day on opening day, as a smattering of players making their MLB debuts were unbelievably sensational. On Thursday, we're going to run through those performances and give these newbies some love.
There were a lot of ridiculous stats surrounding the amount of production. I know you put out kind of a collection of like a collective slash line from rookies, but yeah. How about this one? I know OptiStats is usually churning out some pretty ones. I have not started my arbitrary stats thread yet, and OptiStats is usually exempt from that because of how often they're churning out numbers that you could never possibly come up with. However, this one certainly caught my attention. There have been over 25,000 days of games in MLB history. Today is the only one where three different players homered in their MLB debuts: Carson Benge, Munetaka Murakami, J.J. Weatherholt. And this tweet came before the technical major league debut of one Chase DeLauter of the Cleveland Guardians, who did make his major league debut in the postseason last year, but his first regular season game last night in Seattle, he hits two home runs. So we have a lot of rookies raking to get to. Let's begin with Kevin McGonigal, who did not homer, but I do think he's the right place to start. But before we get to K-Mac, what do you want to say?
I would just like to read the slash line again. The one that I tweeted out was before DeLauter homered twice. Okay? So this is according to True Media. Shouts out. You can sort by rookies. I've done that. Yesterday, rookies slashed 465, 510, 907 for a 14-17 OPS. Okay. They went 20 for 43 with four doubles and five home runs. Those five home runs belonging to Murakami, Carson Benge, J.J. Weatherholt, and then two from Chase DeLauter. Only one rookie went hitless yesterday, and that was Moises Ballesteros of the Chicago Cubs. Mm. Besides that, every single rookie got a knock on opening day.
And we should mention, not all of these rookies were making their major league debuts. However, a lot of them were, which is what made yesterday so cool. So let's go back to McGonigal. Now, he did not hit a home run. However, he supplied four of those hits. And four hits in a major league debut is not a thing you see very often. I believe it was just the 21st time since 1900, we have seen it. I think he's the third youngest ever to give us that performance in a first ever major league game. And we kind of set the stage for McGonigal's debut when he made the team earlier this week. And we talked about how the Tigers looked at it and they were like, look, this guy's one of our best hitters right now. We're trying to win a World Series. He can help us. Boy, can he help us. Because for him to come out in the first inning, jump on the first pitch that he sees from Nick Pivetta and hit a two-run double, his next at-bat, a double off the top of the wall. He beats out an infield single with elite sprint speed. He dumps a fourth hit later on against the tough lefty in Wandy Peralta. It was the whole encapsulation of Kevin McGonigal, the hitter. I know he doesn't have his home run quite yet, but it's a game-changing bat. The confidence, the aggressiveness, the bat-to-ball skills, all of it is just was like, yep, there it is. This is Kevin McGonigal. This is why, unfortunately, he will. I'm wearing my Toledo Mud Hens hat to tip my cap to a team that will never see Kevin McGonigal, at least until his never again. He skipped it. Toledo will never get to claim Kevin McGonigal until his first. I guess hopefully we're not hoping he gets hurt, of course, but that's going to be their only chance to have Kevin McGonigal play in Toledo, because otherwise this guy's going to be a big deal in Detroit for a long time. It was just, oh my goodness, did he look in place and immediately like, yep, that guy is one of their best hitters.
It's like, here are all the things this guy can do. Oh, so he's going to do it immediately. Oh, okay. Yeah, that works for me. And that to me was a theme of the day yesterday, is that all of the players, all of these rookies, it wasn't just that they had good days. It was that they did the headline thing that makes them special. McGonigal is going to be a hit machine. Chase DeLauder, who we should talk about next, who went yard twice for the Cleveland Guardians. The biggest hit he had yesterday was maybe not even a homer. It was a single in the seventh inning with two outs, hitting ahead of Jose Ramirez, that brought Ramirez to the plate. Ramirez then hit a two-run double to break up the tie. And one of the things about DeLauder that's so important is that the Guardians have not had a sidekick like this for Ramirez. With all due respect to Josh Naylor and Stephen Kwan, DeLauder, from an impact perspective, is kind of on a different level in terms of that power hit combo that he's going to be able to provide. And for him to do that right away by going yard twice and also kind of having this alley-oop moment for Ramirez was just perfect narrative stuff.
Specifically hitting second. Jose Ramirez does not like hitting second. And while it has become very common to have your best hitter batting second, that is not something that Jose Ramirez really wants to do. And so they've had these lineups where it's like Kwan at the top, and when Kwan is going, like, that's great. Or Naylor behind Ramirez batting fourth, and Naylor's been an all-star, and that's been nice. But that two-hole has just been like they haven't quite solved that. And for them to just have DeLauder in his first regular season game, like, yeah, no, you're clearly the guy. He was unbelievable in spring training. His last game of spring training was a two-homer game, and now his first regular season game is also a two-homer game. Just quickly, a couple more things on DeLauder, then we'll go to Weatherholt. I mean, he is in the pantheon of if this guy can stay healthy, which of course you apply to a lot of players in a lot of sports, but in baseball, we've had versions of it before.
DeLauder should be on the Twins.
I mean, he certainly embodies that that many Twins prospects have it, and Twins, you know, superstars like Byron Buxton have over the years. But it really cannot be he's barely played baseball, okay? He played 66 games in college, okay? So let's go with that, because his junior year, he broke his foot and he missed most of his draft year. Okay, so 66 games over 3 years in college. That's not a lot of baseball. He's drafted in 2022 in the first round. Since he was drafted in 2022, he's only played 138 games in the minor leagues over 3.5 professional seasons. That is how often this guy has been getting injured. It's just been every little thing here and there. Some of them are freak injuries. Some of them are soft tissue. Some of them are hit by pitch. Like, all of it. But it's been so bad to the point where part of the reason why he didn't come up before the postseason last year, although it looks so silly in retrospect, clearly he could have helped in September if he was ready and they were confident enough to do it, is because them managing his physical workload has just been a challenge. And this weird push and pull of we don't want to drive this guy beyond his physical, what has proven to be a challenge for him to stay on the field. And yet they know he's one of their best players. Yeah. I think coming into this season, there was the thought, oh, are they going to still slow play this? Because they're still worried about him going too fast too soon. And they just, after the spring that he had and realizing we need him right now, now you understand why. And yeah, I mean, it just completely changes the complexion of the lineup.
He fast played one over the fence is what he played. Let's move on to Weatherholt, who did the same twice. Let's move on to Weatherholt, who did the same. So, you know, Weatherholt, seventh overall pick in 2024. Yep. Time flies when you're having fun. Making his MLB debut for the Cardinals, he goes yard on an 0-2 fastball that is not a strike. It is like a ball and a half to two balls out and up. And he just gets the barrel to it and hits it to dead center. And this type of in-box move is what makes J.J. Weatherholt special. That he is reading the game at the plate in slow motion. You know, like in GTA when you're driving and you can go into slow-mo mode to weave through traffic?
Franklin?
That is what Franklin's special ability. Decision-making. Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. That is the decision-making and the movement here from Weatherholt where he's like, this is from Brendan Schaefer, who covers the Cardinals for MLB.com. Weatherholt told me that after getting down 0-2, he was expecting Rasmussen to throw him something hard up and away to elicit a chase. That's what happened. JJ said if he saw it a little lower, he would stay calm and take a lighter swing at it. For that process to, one, happen exactly that way for his first MLB hit, and two, turn into this home run is wild. That's it. That's the whole thing. This guy's a freako. And for him to, again, show it immediately out of the gate on opening day was sublime.
And his explanation there, he gave a very similar answer to Jim Hayes on the field after the game. And normally when you read quotes like that, like, oh, I'm not trying to overswing, not trying to do too much, it just washes over you as cliche and you don't feel like you learn anything. But for him to be able to explain the process, and then when you watch the at-bat, because he had swung through a fastball and a cutter in the same spot, they were both outside. And then to be able to realize, like, wait a minute, I'm J.J. Weatherholt. I have this incredible bat-to-ball skill. I have juice. Like, this was the thing. Everyone knew J.J. Weatherholt could hit. But even when he was a draft prospect, it was, okay, how much power is he going to have? No, he's got that. He has that juice. And he knows, I got to touch it. I just got to barrel it up. And he's able to barrel up a pitch like that from a really good pitcher in Drew Rasmussen. So impressive. And then he gets the sack fly later as part of this ridiculous Cardinals rally. They had 8 runs. That game was nuts. That was maybe the best game of the day, as chaotic as it was and as maybe not relevant as the teams are going to be. But I am going to be tuning into so much JJ this season, no matter how boring the Cardinals are. I cannot wait to watch more of him.
Two other quick ones here, and then I'll let you do Murakami. Justin Crawford, Philadelphia Phillies, 2 hits, both of them singles up the middle that found some space. That's the bit, okay? That's how he's going to be good, at least at the start. He does not hit the ball in the air that much, but he hits it hard on the ground, and he hits it to the backside, and he can really fly. Cool to see him get 2. And then the one that kind of got overshadowed because the Reds looked terrible yesterday was Sal Stewart going 3-for-4, first baseman, third baseman. Played first yesterday for the Reds. 2 of those hits off Crochet, 1 of them off Garrett Whitlock. That's big boy stuff. Sal's going to be a very special hitter. What do you want to say about Murakami? And then I'll do Bench.
We're going to save Murakami for later because Murakami was not bad, but his home run in the context of the White Sox was unintentionally very funny. So let's finish with Carson Bench because you were there in the building at Citi Field for a game that I think will be remembered most for what happened at the beginning, but as far as positive Mets moments, I think the Carson Bench home run, his first home run and first hit of his career, again, like, it's incredible. Normally these moments, like, if you have one of these in a day, that's like the story of the day. The fact that we had 3, 4 of them, 5 of them, 6 of them was why we are leading this show with rookies. But what did you see from Bench up close?
So that game was sort of a slog. You know, Skeens leaves in the first because O'Neill Cruz sucks at defense. And then, like, the Mets are having good at-bats and working deep counts and walks. But their only two extra base hits before Benj goes yard were the two Cruz screw ups. They like were not really hitting it that hard. And I turned to someone, I was like, the Mets are really not hitting the ball that well. And then boom, there goes Benj, lofting a Justin Lawrence middle sweeper over the wall in right field for his first career home run. The Oklahoma State product made the team out of camp in part because Mike Tauchman went down and in part because he is ready for this. The Mets brass, they have spoken very highly of him and his poise and his maturity. And he admitted to being nervous in his first at bat where he struck out on three pitches against Paul Skeens, which is defensible. Settled into the game, went yard. He is the second player in Mets history to make their MLB debut on opening day and hit a home run. Carson Benj and Kaz Matsui. That might be the only thing those guys share besides like baseball gloves. a great, great little duo. And then it was cool to be around after the game. You know, we go down for clubhouse and there is no one around and whatever. So I just went out to the field. And so it was Benj and like the entire, you know, state of Oklahoma there to greet him. It was, I think he said he had 22 people and a dog. I don't know where the dog was during the game. I asked Mets PR, is like, hey, how'd they get that dog in there? And they declined to comment. but this is cool. Like that's what it's all about moment. Right. And he spoke about the people that made the sacrifices to help him get to this position. So it was cool to see Carson Benj step up and, you know, the Mets, this is what I wrote about, and we'll take a break. Every year, opening day is about this like blank slate, clean canvas, hope springs eternal. And for teams like the Yankees or the Phillies that expect to contend, but expect to contend with like the same exact team, it's kind of harder to sell that sense of optimism and rebirth when you're like, hey, remember last opening day? Yeah, this is pretty similar. Whereas for the Mets, Mets fans were like, what the hell is this new baseball team? What is this going to be? How is this going to go? Who are these people? Of the 16 people that appeared in the Mets' final ball game in 2025 in Miami when they lost on the final day 4-0, okay? One of the most soul-crushing evenings, afternoons in a franchise history littered with crushing afternoons. Of those 16 people, just three of them played yesterday. Just three. Lindor, Soto, Francisco Alvarez. Okay? The rest of that group, starting pitcher, bullpen, the six other everyday players were either in AAA with the Mets, on other teams, or on the bench. And I give David Stearns, their Pobo, a lot of credit for being willing to wipe the slate clean. And that dynamic just presented a very unique situation at Citi Field yesterday, where it's like, we're contenders, but also, who are we?
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say about Benj, and then we'll take a break, is, you know, when you're a Mets fan, now as a Mets fan, you know that part of it is that you have all this money and you can go sign all these players and extend all these players and trade for all these players and so forth. But this is true. This isn't just for teams like that. But the homegrown guys are just different, man. Like, and for yesterday's game, to have Beatty have the big triple against Skeens, Alvarez to homer right after Benj, right? Those are the three homegrown guys. Of course, they're going to love Juan Soto and Lindor and Bichette and Polanco eventually and Robert, you know, and so forth. Sammy and, you know, Freddy Peralta, of course, opening day starter they just traded for. It's not that those guys aren't going to get their own fans and fans aren't going to buy their jerseys. But I think it's really important for Mets fans to also have that next wave, especially as you have aggressively and dramatically closed the book on Jeff McNeil and Brandon Nimmo.
Burned the book.
Yeah. right. Closed it, shredded it, you know, burned it, whatever you want to do. That era of like our Mets that we drafted and we developed, gone. It's over, right? So now Benj is such an important
new crop.
And Beatty, we started to Beatty and Alvarez, and maybe Vientos finds his way back into this or two. That is so important. and now McLean, right, and Tong, and we'll see. So I think that was also a really, really cool part of that first day. And as for Skeens, like, I mean, whatever. Hey, we'll talk about him when we get to the opening day starter draft. How about that? But until then, we are going to take a quick break. And before I do, let me remind you folks that while the season has begun, there is still time to draft your fantasy baseball team. And we hope that you do it here at Yahoo. Draft with your friends or join a public league at Yahoo Fantasy. Sign up in the Yahoo Fantasy app or at yahoofantasy.com/baseball. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, a lot more that we need to talk about.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Something was very different about this opening day than previous opening days. We have to talk about it. ABS, which, to be clear, does not stand for automatic ball strike, which I admittedly thought it did for a bit. I mean, that would make sense. Like, if we're talking about a balls and strike system, you would think that the B would be ball and the S would be strike, but it's not. The B is ball strike, ball dash strike, like a hyphenated last name, and S is system. It is automated ball strike system. It should really be ABSS. Anyway, this is all to say that the Robo Umps are here, and they were a story on opening day, the first ever ABS challenge in MLB history during the regular season. Netflix missed it. We'll talk about Netflix later. They missed it. This is not Lauren Shahadi's fault. She does a really good job. Someone in the truck screwed this up. Jose Caballero screwed this up by deciding to challenge at this moment, which made absolutely no sense, in part. What a bizarre way for the ABS era to begin. You know, the ABS revolution apparently will not be televised.
It will be streamed by paying customers. Yes, we'll talk about Netflix more later. But once we got past that, and then that game stunk, so there wasn't like a high leverage moment that we were going to see it. On opening day on Thursday, we did have several very compelling examples of this system in action. I know you saw one in Queens that certainly stood out in terms of, I believe it was O'Neill Cruz was batting and he thought he had drawn a walk, but Francisco Alvarez said, "Not so fast, young man. I believe that was actually a strike," to which they go ahead and sent it to the review board and they realize, yes, indeed, that was a strike. Sorry, O'Neill Cruz, you have struck out. And so that meant there was no one on base when Brandon Lau would then hit a home run. We know the Mets go on to blow them out anyway, so how important was that? However, we also had some examples much later on in the game, which you can say absolutely impacted the ultimate result. I think the most notable version of that was in the Red Sox-Reds game, which went to the ninth inning with the Red Sox up just one run. And at the end of the top of the ninth, we had Roman Anthony at the plate. And with two outs and a guy on first, there was what he looked to be strike three from Connor Phillips. However, Roman Anthony, he knows ball. He knows hitting. He knows the zone. He said, let me tap my helmet. Let's take a look. And we had that kind of awkward moment, that strange, unusual interaction where Connor Phillips hops off the mound, goes towards his dugout and says, yes, I just struck out Roman Anthony and I kept this as a one-run game. Instead, we go to the review. We see that it was indeed a ball by a fraction of a millimeter or whatever. Roman Anthony takes his base. Trevor Story singles to make it 2-0. Jaron Duran singles to make it 3-0. They pad the lead. And guess what? When you're facing Aroldis Chapman in the ninth, it's hard enough. But now you're down by 3 runs instead of 1. And that is a big difference in a baseball game that matters. So I think that was probably the most extreme case of the system in action, being used at the right time, and it not necessarily changing the full outcome, but feeling like it made a difference. That felt like the moment that people did want it for. And maybe some people didn't like that. Maybe some people said that that was yeah. weird and unfamiliar. But I think that was a perfect display of why this will make a difference.
I have to say, my biggest criticism of ABS so far is an emotional one. And it is not one that came to mind for me until the games mattered. It was difficult to kind of come up with this take in spring training when it was all exhibition. One of the biggest issues with replay in soccer is that when a goal is scored, so much of the experience of enjoying a soccer match is the jubilation, the outpouring of joy when a goal is scored, right? And then you have to like bottle that for a temporary amount of time, wait for the review, and then either look like an idiot because you already celebrated or like half celebrate again. And that raw feeling of a review changing the emotion of a final out of an inning or a crucial pitch of like putting it into this holding pattern is very odd. Now, we have had this with other types of challenges. I understand that. But this is just another example of it. That is my only kind of downside to the ABS system.
I totally agree with you. And again, we're all going to learn as we go what are the pros and cons of having this. I think you've heard us mostly communicate positivity, optimism, excitement around the system. And I believe I will maintain that for the most part. But what you just described is something I've thought about. And I know that when the pitch clock was introduced, it was something that we were worried about. Like, oh my God, imagine some big moment being ruined in October because the pitch clock runs out and the umpire. And what we've learned is that everybody has just gotten used to the pitch clock, and it's relevant because it's changed our sport for the better in so many ways.
But that's not happening.
Everyone adapted to it. It's just not happening. We have not had to worry about that. This is going to happen. We are going to have these moments that are slightly changed. However, what we're going to find out is that, or I think as teams and players are going to adjust to it, the point is people want calls to be right. People want it to be closer to fair, whatever that means. And again, there's some people that disagree with what that looks like and how that actually manifests with this system. All that said, it's one day, but the other side of the spectrum is there are teams that just straight up weren't challenging, and I couldn't believe it. Like, I know they're all still getting used to this. I know, and I said this over and over in spring training, this is not actually going to tell us what this is going to look like to a full degree. Yes, you can pull out some of the data and be like, okay, maybe this is a theme here and this is when teams are going to use it. Now it's showtime, and I do think it is going to take a while for players and teams to feel comfortable tapping the head, right? There were situations last night, the most egregious one being Cal Raleigh to lead off the eighth inning. He takes a called strike three on the outer half that is, if you're not going to challenge then to lead off an inning in a one-run game down by one when you're Cal Raleigh, like that's, and you're Cal Raleigh, in theory, you would be the person that no one would have any problem with you challenging something. He watches it go by. The Mariners lose a close game. They end up not using a single challenge the whole game. Like, I wouldn't even think that would be possible. And it was a ball. And Cal said after the game, yeah, I should have challenged that. You know, we're still getting used to it. And I get that. But there were multiple teams that did not use any challenges yesterday. And I understand that there's blowouts and there's different game scenarios where it's going to be more likely than not. But frankly, I was stunned that that was the case to the degree that it was even in the first game. And I'm curious how long it takes for teams to realize, like, yeah, guys, let's make sure we're using all of our challenges almost no matter what.
I have one final ABS thing. Of the challenges that were used yesterday, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but I think it was like around 25-ish. One was a pitcher. One pitcher tapped their head yesterday.
Who was it? I missed that one.
The first pitcher, Zach Pop of the Philadelphia Phillies, a reliever for the Philadelphia Phillies, tapped his head to challenge a pitch. And let me tell you, this was the perfect advertisement for anybody that does not want the pitcher to challenge, because it was very much a ball. And Zach Pop, in a fit of emotion, just tapped his head. Like, there was certainly no conversation before the game where the whole team sat in the room and the lead strategist said, all right, guys, in terms of how we want to use our challenges, let's give them to Kyle Schwarber, Bryce Harper, and Zach Pop. Let's make sure Pop's got one later on. Pop, you get one. Make sure you use that challenge. Pop, not the time to pop this. Okay? Should have kept it in your pocket. It was so funny. I recommend going back and watching it because it's like, this is why teams are going to have edicts. No pitchers. Pitchers not allowed to do this.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, this is, at this point, this is top of the eighth. The Phillies are up 5-0. This is why Zach Pop is even pitching. With all due respect to Zach Pop, who I have said, like, yeah, this guy could be a decent reliever. There's a reason this was not necessarily the highest of leverage. It was the end of a 8-pitch at bat against Brandon Nimmo. It was a close call, low and in. It was close, but it was a ball, and that was indeed confirmed. So yeah, it's fascinating, and what a trivia question that is. You know, the first pitcher and maybe the last Phillies pitcher that will challenge this. And how this all evolves. It's one day of data, so we don't want to freak out about it too much. But I will say, I will admit to being very surprised that from what I can tell, 7 teams that played yesterday, or I guess including the Giants, I know that was a blowout, did not challenge one time. Like, I can't. What? Really? You can't buy one call where you're like, let's see what happens. Like,
it's, I know, funny, the game's because countdown, that thought process reinforces an idea that, like, the ups are perfect. It's like, couldn't use it. They were perfect.
And that's the thing. The social element of this, the psychological element of it, we talk about it with the umps don't want to be embarrassed. No, the players also aren't going to want to be embarrassed. I think eventually they'll overcome that because, as with anything in this game, what do they care about? Winning, putting up numbers. So I do think that there's going to be a situation where players in blowouts, If they're a hitter who's like going into arbitration and they have a better chance of hitting a home run and making a little bit more money the next season, if they flip the count from 1-2 to 2-1 in the seventh inning where they're down by 10, I don't think you're just going to sit there and not challenge pitches. I think you're going to start to see players more comfortable with that. But that dynamic is going to be so interesting, and I do think it's going to take some time for players to get used to it. And that's why I love, man. It was a great first day in that respect for giving us stuff to talk about with ABS.
Let's go around the league. Got a couple more things to chat about. Last night was the first baseball game at a new stadium, a new field. Uniqlo Field at Dodger Stadium was unveiled. Finally, big, huge day for Uniqlo. Congratulations to Uniqlo. This will be the last time. I mean, I do shop at Uniqlo. I like some of their pants, but this will be the last time that we say the words Uniqlo Field. Like, we're not gonna, right?
Disagree. Yeah, because it becomes the same way we talk about, you know, Roku leadoff. Like, some of these corporate sponsorships almost become ironically funny.
They're so clunky.
And that's not, I guess, the goal, but it's all part of it. You just want your name out there, and this is the right time to have your name next to anything involving the Los Angeles Dodgers, which is really my takeaway here. I'm sure that there are some Dodgers fans who've been going to Dodger Stadium for their entire lives who are sickened by this, whether they like Uniqlo's sweatpants or not. At the same time, it's the least surprising thing ever. It is a Japanese clothing line that has the opportunity to partner with the team.
Clothing line.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Well, sorry. You want to correct me on that? Like, what am I saying wrong?
It's more like a store than a line. Like a line, a clothing line, okay. I think, presents like a higher level of like fashionistiness. But what do I know? What do I know?
Well, clearly more than me, because I didn't know that I said the wrong words there.
Email us. But email us. BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com. BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com. Is Uniqlo a fashion line or a clothing line or a clothing company? Maybe I'm nitpicking.
Last thing I'll say on this is, like, it's so unsurprising. We get these press releases from the Dodgers all the time, and the number of just random Japanese companies, not just Japanese, but a lot of Japanese companies that are constantly partnering with the Dodgers. These are products. This one is at least a store that I am familiar with, that I have seen worn by people that I know. There's all kinds of partnerships happening all the time between the Dodgers and these companies that they're constantly announcing, because this is just how, yes, duh.
Right.
Why does any of this happen? Because the Dodgers
like, you don't need to go buy paint.
Spend on Kyle Tucker and, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to go buy this Japanese paint, right? Like, you're so right. This is why the money's there. Like, this is kind of the whole thing. This is why Ohtani is a bargain, everybody, because they're making the money back on things like Uniqlo Field. So anyway, yeah, I'm currently not wearing my Klo pants, my clothing line from Klo.
Okay, but you do have some.
I do.
It's a brand that I've always looked at and been like, oh, I would probably like their clothing. I don't think I've ever purchased anything from there. So does this make me
Uniqlo,
more
if you have any money left after this sponsorship deal, email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Speaking of things that you can wear. We got a list of the most popular baseball jerseys. Okay, this is since October, I believe. The most popular jerseys in Major League Baseball. Please go ahead and confirm the timeline for me while I read this list off. I'll just do the top three are kind of obvious. Number one is Los Angeles Dodgers two-way player Shohei Ohtani, followed by Yoshinobu Yamamoto at 2, Judge at 3, Raleigh 4, Mookie Betts 5. Nolan Arenado at 6 with the Arizona Diamondbacks is shocking to me. This must be like an off-season list. There's no way this includes October.
It is. It does say since the culmination of the 2025 World Series. But even still, that blows my mind.
Who are you guys?
Honestly, like respect to the Snakes fans that I did not realize were that excited to essentially buy Nolan Arenado, on the cheap, a future Hall of Famer. So, I mean, that is certainly impressive. The other name that stands out on here, but again, because of the timing makes sense, is Josh Naylor making this list, right? Josh Naylor with the Mariners being on here in the top 20. I think that also stands
and
out.
Pete Alonso,
like the fact that he's on here
at 8.
Yeah, but the fact that Josh Naylor's on here and Julio isn't, right? I mean, Cal's in the top 5, but that is notable. I mean, both of those guys went to the Game 7 of the ALCS. Pete, that one does not surprise me. That's exactly the offseason one that I would expect would, unlike Arenado, but him being behind Arenado, I does not totally compute.
Yeah.
This is a fun list. This is a The timing of it definitely makes a difference. I'd be curious to see where we're at in 4 months, right?
Yeah.
Nolan Arenado is still in the top 20 in 4 months.
Whew. Can we see the bottom of this list?
That would be impressive.
Like, here are the 5 least purchased jerseys that were still purchased. You know, like...
been purchased at least once.
That
you set a minimum,
here's your
right?
Grant Wolfram, 1. the last thing to chat about before we take a break... is Nico Hoerner. Nico Hoerner signing a 6-year contract extension with the Chicago Cubs. This is kind of a big deal because Nico Hoerner was tracking as one of the best bats on the free agent market this winter, and now he will not be on the free agent market this winter.
May I remind you, Jake, that my bold prediction was that Nico Hoerner was going to have a great season and be the first player to sign an extension or sign the biggest contract before the lockout, I think was my prediction.
Non-school already wrong. Division.
I mean, yes and
before
no.
The lockout. Well,
first of all, we don't know at the time of this recording, we don't know the money, which is kind of surprising. It is reportedly a 6-year deal. I expect it to be very similar to the one they signed PCA to. I know he's much older than PCA, but because he's that much closer to free agency and has this longer track record, I think Nico Hoerner is going to get $100 million. I mean, we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong on that. It's a very stupid way to judge this, but I am curious how that contract will then compare to the other largest contracts that are signed this offseason.
Yes.
Because he was going to be one of the best players available, and now he will not be because the Cubs are committing even further to him, which I also think is important because now their infield is just set for essentially the next 5 seasons with Bush, Hoerner, Swanson, Bregman. So Matt Shaw, if you can figure out how to play outfield, that's your only chance to being a regular on this team because now you have your infield completely. I don't know if they're the only team in baseball that can say that. We know what our infield is for the next 5 seasons. it might just be them. And that's kind of why you do it. It's one less thing to think about.
Also, just a reminder, the hitters for the upcoming offseason kind of stink as far as free agency is concerned.
Yeah.
Bo Bichette could opt out of $55.3 million, but, you know, might not. So it'll be Jazz. It'll be Alec Bohm. It'll be Dalton Varsho. Randy.
Jazz.
Glaber again. One. Jazz is a big one, but how many position players this winter get over $100 million? I would say the line is 1.5. I would say Jazz probably does, and I don't know if anyone else does.
Right. And Nico Horner potentially could have been in that discussion, and maybe that is part of why the Cubs were like, you know what? This is only going to get more expensive if we want to keep him. So let's just get this done. We're going to take a break.
You know
what?
I take that back. Hey, I take that back. I believe that Ronald Acuna Jr. has a $17 million team option. So the Braves could decline that in theory, you know.
I'm going to assume that's not going to happen. But thank you for clarifying.
Okay.
I do appreciate it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say.
We're going to take a break.
Okay.
When we return, an update on the opening day starter draft and a mega edition of the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we get to the good, the bad, the ugly, we got a little bit of business to attend to. And that is an update on the opening day starter draft, which after one night was looking pretty good for Team Jake. Logan Webb got smoked by the New York Yankees on opening night on Netflix. How embarrassing. Max Fried was terrific for Team Jake. That put me in quite the hole. However, on Thursday,
my team sure did rally.
Jake was like, no, let's not. It's the opening night starter draft, right?
Opening night starter draft. I win 1-0.
That's what we were doing. No, I had a much better day on Thursday, as at the conclusion of Thursday's action, my team had a 3.20 ERA in 56 and a third innings. Jake's, 4.83 in 59 and two thirds. Was there some misfortune there with whatever was going on with O'Neill Cruz in center field with Paul Skeens not getting out of the first inning? Yeah, that was tough. That was tough. That isn't the reason you are losing right now, but it certainly makes it harder for you to come back. However, this is not over. Job is not finished for Team Jordan. And there are some potential pitfalls for me because I have four more pitchers going today and you only have two. Jake sending Cole Reagans to the bump, as well as main character Kyle Freeland against the Marlins. I've still got Chris Sale, Sandy Alcantara, Kevin Gausman, and Luis Severino. So I'm not, listen, I'm feeling good after yesterday, but we got some work to do. We got to close this thing out. And if Kyle Freeland goes out and dominates the Marlins and Chris Sale gets blasted by the Royals and Severino's getting torched by the Blue Jays and the Rockies come to play, maybe I still lose this, but we will see what happens.
If Skeens had a normal bad day, I would be within shouting distance of you. However, because he acquired two outs and allowed five fake earned runs, I have no chance. I really don't think I have a chance. Only, I guess, one of those Skeens runs should have been real, maybe two. But because O'Neill Cruz did not touch either baseball that he misplayed, they are ruled as hits and not errors, and therefore these runs are earned. That is just, I know we're doing earned runs here, and this is the rule. I'm not, you know, bickering about that. Great example of why earned runs are not always the best metric with which to grade pitchers. Okay. If Paul Skeens ends up with a 2.5, okay, and not a 2.2, like O'Neill Cruz needs to buy his ass a watch or something.
You are correct. However, as someone who also boldly predicted that Bubba Chandler will have a lower ERA than Paul Skeens, this is at least giving me a nice little cushion for the rest of the season. We will be looking back on this stupid inning potentially all season for multiple reasons.
You bring up Bubba Chandler, and this is a great transition into the good, the bad, the ugly, because this is just a bonus ugly on top of an already bonus ugly. Did you see the Pirates season beginning like hype video that they tweeted out?
No,
you
know,
all
I didn't.
These teams like do these.
No, I know. I thought videos. About doing a taxonomy of those, but I didn't have time. Yeah, what happened?
The Pirates one was actually, it was pretty good. It was like talking about how like they're all playing for Pittsburgh, and it was like the players watching videos of diehard Pirates freakos, I say that lovingly, talking about how much they want the Pirates to finally freaking win. And so they're sitting there like seeing how much it, look how much it means to them, right? And then the, yeah. the players then react and kind of say what they feel about it. And Bubba Chandler said something that I don't believe. Okay. Believe this is Bubba. Yeah, it's Bubba. Quote, we got a lot of guys in there that would die for the city of Pittsburgh.
Whoa. Whoa.
I don't yeah. believe that.
And it's like, you know, we just don't.
Also,
I trust that you care.
I believe okay. you care. You shouldn't be willing to die for the city of Pittsburgh, Bubba.
We're playing baseball.
You shouldn't. Baseball. Isn't that the plot playing of the baseball. Third Batman movie?
All right. That is ugly.
Would you die?
But we have.
Would you die for Pittsburgh more. Care? Actually, email us. Pittsburghers. Pittsburghers. Email us. Yinzers.
Yeah.
Email us. BaseballBarbergets@gmail.com. Do you want. Would you be okay with Bubba Chandler dying for the city of Pittsburgh? You don't want that, do you? No.
I have a Pirates fan in mind that I'm excited to text about this.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to doing that. All right, let's get some more ugly and good and bad. The good, the bad, and the ugly. First one of the regular season.
Because there is so much, because we are trying to drink from a fire hose here on opening day, we're going to double up. We're going to throw that pitch again. This is the first ever edition of the good, good, bad, bad, and ugly, ugly. Both myself and Jordan will offer two of each. So buckle up, strap in, and let's get down to business to defeat the Huns. Jordan Schusterman, let's go back and forth. What is good for you?
My good is also ugly and also bad, but it is more good because it made me laugh so hard. And that is what occurred, not from opening day. This is the highlight of spring training. As I mentioned, I don't watch a lot of spring training. But did you see what happened on the Twins broadcast earlier this week?
Oh.
And what has occurred since?
Byron Buxton's yeah. pants being down, yeah. Please explain this concisely.
Corey Provis, the play-by-play, Glenn Perkins in the booth, had an all-time moment. Now, there are broadcast mishaps that have gotten people fired, that have embarrassed people, that have derailed careers, and also moments that are very funny and then are parlayed into more jokes along the way. And that is why this isn't good, because the Twins have taken this moment and have run with it in a way that I very much appreciate. Essentially, what happened is Byron Buxton, playing in a spring training game earlier this week, his pants, his baseball pants, were he did not have his socks up, okay? So he was wearing his pants down. That is a thing that people say, right, Jake? You can confirm that. You're a baseball player. He was wearing his pants down, right? That's a way you would say that if his socks are up, you wouldn't say socks down. Yeah. You would say, like, he's wearing his, right? That's a thing. So, okay.
Yeah, if your socks are not showing, yep. you're wearing your pants down.
However, unfortunately, again, these are just things we get used to saying in baseball.
Most people. Oh, yeah, it's raining. The game's banged.
Okay, that's weird. So we had this back and forth between Corey Provis and former Twins pitcher Glenn Perkins, where there is a pause and they're showing Byron Buxton, and Glenn Perkins goes, "You ever see Buck with his pants down?" To which there is then an incredible back and forth. He's, of course, talking about the socks. And it's true. Byron Buxton normally has the socks up. Anyway, the back and forth initially was amazing. the conclusion of it was, I think, my favorite part, which is Corey Provost going, oh yeah, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Oh, it's just so funny. Oh, my God. It's so funny. Anyway, this then continues. The next day, they basically have another back and forth overemphasizing that they are talking about baseball pants. And then, finally, with a promotion for the new Twins streaming service, Twins TV, which that is a separate conversation, Glenn Perkins, in pitching that you should sign up for Twins TV, saying, don't get caught with your pants down. Sign up for Twins TV as part of the official promotional video for this, that they are clearly leaning into this mishap. This whole sequence is great. Well done, everybody. This could have been so much worse and so much more awkward. Instead, they had the right attitude around this. And pants down. Good. Thank you. Good.
You know what this made me?
That's my first good.
This set me into a rabbit hole. Of, do you remember, pants on the ground, pants on the ground, fucking all around with your pants on the ground, get them up.
Yeah.
If you don't know what I'm talking about.
Thankfully, we're not talking about pants all the way on the ground, which is a very key distinction. It is just
that
they're pants closer to his cleats. Okay, not as catchy. That is what is happening.
His pants are not on the sleeves. Ground. His pants sleeves were down. He was wearing long pants sleeves.
Anyway. That's my first good. What is your first good?
Great. Joey Votto bought the Reds a clock. A beautiful red, old-fashioned looking clock. And he had the city of Cincinnati and the Reds put it like in a very, you know, aesthetically pleasing place right in the entrance of Great American Ballpark. And the reason why this is good is that no other player in the history of our sport would buy his own former team a clock. Let me just be clear. This is not like a clock on a wall or like a watch, like a nice watch. Guys buy each other nice watches all the time in baseball. This is like a clock tower type deal. This is like the type of clock that you would see if you were in London in 1907 and you were trying to catch a train and you were at the station and you needed to see what time it was. And for Joey Votto to be like, I'd like to get the Reds something nice, I'm going to get them a clock. That says so much about Joey Votto. And the video of him explaining this, of him saying the Cincinnati Reds are special and they deserve some special things, the level of thought that he put into this is just a reminder of how special Joey Votto is. That the Reds fans had that special thing for so long, and they will probably have him forever, as it seems like he's going to reemerge into our lives after a year of, you know, baseball rumspringa. We went on walkabout. We didn't hear from him at all for 365, but now he's back, and that is so, 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 so good.
Yes, looking forward to his, you know, broadcast debut whenever that comes this year. We know he's going to be part of that NBC group. And the last thing I'll say about this is I never really thought about it as like a parallel to what you just pointed out, which is true, which is that they like to buy each other watches, right? Like that's a normal thing. That happened. We saw Ohtani bought all of his Dodgers teammates watches, right? That happens all the time. And so I don't know if Joey Votto just has a passion for these kinds of clocks. Very possible because it's Joey Votto. Or he was like, how can I supersize this gift? Because that is what the Reds mean to me. And it's perfect. It's beautiful.
It's also so, great.
Shouts out Joey Votto.
Because this is not a gift that you can really get a person. Like you can't get a person a clock that big. You know?
No. He got it for the city, for the ballpark, for the fans, and they will all get to enjoy it and see.
Can you imagine?
That is Joey.
You're the person who works for the Reds that like gets this phone call and it's Joey. He's like, hey, I'd like to buy you guys a clock, please.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we do get like a behind the scenes story on this from someone who writes about the Reds. So I look forward to that. But it is great because also like Joey Votto is going to have a statue there at some point, and instead he preempted it. He was like, actually, here's my clock, which is so great. Anyway, that is so good. Okay. My second good is another first baseman. I don't know if he's ever going to have a statue in any of his stadiums one day, but we love him nonetheless. And that is Rhys Hoskins, Sacramento, who's now in the Cleveland Guardians.
Sacramento State. Build him a statue.
Sac State, yes. Rhys Hoskins is on the Guardians now. That certainly brings me joy as one of our favorites over the years, who now will be playing his baseball close by to me. However, Rhys Hoskins, in his Guardians debut against Seattle last night, hardest hit ball of his career? What? This dude's hit a lot of home runs. He's hit the ball hard for a long time. I know he's been injured and not as impactful for the last few years. This dude hit a double in the top of the second in his first at-bat as a Guardian. 112.3 off the bat, narrowly edging out. I believe he did have one, like 112.0 earlier in his career with the Phillies. This is just a very simple fun fact that completely blew my mind. And I don't know if this is another one of those like, uh-oh, guys, the balls are juiced again. Very possible. There were some other strange batted balls yesterday, but I know Jake doesn't like to talk about that. But Rhys looked great yesterday, at least swinging the bat. Running to second base, maybe not as much, but that's fine. Speed was never his
game.
Not
his job.
If this guy can get on base and hit the ball this hard, that is going to be a huge deal for this Guardians lineup. Like, they won the division with the 29th ranked OPS last season. If they now have Chase DeLauder and Rhys Hoskins just giving them good at-bats, that might be all it takes to win the division again, truly. We will see, but it is so cool to see Rhys just swinging the bat and hitting the ball hard. That was very simple good for me.
Rhys is sneaky getting up there in age. Like, we've been around him for a while, and the idea that he's 33 makes me feel old, but not as old as my next good.
Well done.
Arthur Green.
Well done.
Arthur Green is a 109-year-old World War II veteran, and he threw out the first pitch in Baltimore on opening day. That's it, guys. He wore a jersey with number 109, and his pitch, while how many feet did this go, do you think? Arthur Green's pitch, maybe 10 feet, was way better than you could ever expect from a 109-year-old, okay? This is easily in the 100th percentile of first pitches thrown by 109-year-olds.
This is easily in the 100th percentile of most impressive first pitches.
Yeah.
He walked out there. Like, we've seen other veterans or, like, old, like, be wheeled out in a wheelchair. That's completely understandable. And it looked like he did have a walker. He was, I assume this is a family member that is kind of escorting him out there, but 109 and he's standing out there and is able to throw the ball in the general direction of Gunnar Henderson. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'm so impressed. Arthur Green, as good as it gets. Very, very well done. All right.
Get him on the bump.
Let's go. Orioles could use him. Let's go to bad. My bad. My first bad is what happened at the hockey match between the Toronto Maple Leafs and the some other team that they were playing.
Not the Sabres. Toronto.
Not the Sabres, so I don't care. Where the Blue Jays, since their opening day is not until Friday, decided to take in some puck. And Ernie Clement and George Springer were kicked out of their seats. They were sitting in the wrong seats. Now, why is this bad? It's bad for pretty much everybody involved. It's bad because I don't know why. Like, I like that Ernie and George wanted to go down and sit closer to the glass, even though they clearly had a suite that, like, everybody was hanging out in. So yeah. I don't know if they just assumed they could go sit anywhere because they're Ernie Clement and George Springer, which would totally be understandable. But it does seem like the usher decided, hey, no, like, your seats are over there, which tells me they did have tickets and then they just didn't know how to read a seating chart, which is bad. Sorry, Ernie and George. That's not very relatable for you to just unintentionally sit in the wrong seat. But then also the usher going to these Blue Jays World Series heroes and saying, yeah, sorry, guy, you can't sit here in Toronto is a tough look. So I think there was a lot of bad here. It's very funny, and I'm obviously not actually being that serious, but I do think there were some mistakes
made
for all parties involved here.
The funniest part is stars are just like us because they then have to – their seats are in the middle of a row. So they have to, like, sneak through the row to like walk by all these people who were probably like living and dying with their every moment in October. And like these guys probably don't sit in seats, real seats all the time. And so it was very funny to watch this.
That's my
I will
first
keep
bad.
Things light with my first bad, which was the Citi Field national anthem yesterday. Jordan, did you see this?
Yeah, I did.
So the lyrics to the national anthem, I feel like at this point, they're pretty set. Like, I don't think there's
they a sure
lot of
sing
room
it a lot.
For
so,
adaptation. Yeah. I have it in front of me, in fact. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? That is not what Chris Jackson, who played George Washington in Alexander Hamilton, said yesterday. Now, the thing about Chris Jackson singing the national anthem here is that this guy, he's got a good voice, has sung the national anthem many times in baseball games. Like, I think we have seen him sing it at least 10 times.
Absolutely.
Always at the Yankees. Always at the Yankees. This guy's a Yankee fan, dude, for sure. This guy is definitely a Yankee fan. And I can't believe that the Mets brought out the Yankee fan, and I can't believe that he sang it wrong, considering how often he sang it. Instead of what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, he said, what so proudly we hailed were so gallantly streaming. That's later. Mm-hmm. Maybe this was a Mark DeRosa. Maybe he just miscalculated the lyrics here, misspeaking. But this is bad. Got to say the words right, I think. Right? I've made mistakes.
Yeah, also,
but
first one of the year. Like, I mean, I've seen people flub it in, you know, at double A games, and there's, you know, 6,000 people there.
The kid this gets nervous, the crowd sings along.
Time. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Like, sometimes it can be cause for like a really heartwarming moment. You
Chris
know,
Jackson,
if
you're
a Broadway
you're no
star, no one's like getting in there and be like, let's help him out. It's like, no, you probably should have gotten it right the first time. My second bad is the White Sox struck out 20 times in a 9-inning baseball game, which tied a major league record. It only happened 9 times before. And this is how the season began. Now, it is unfortunate because this season actually began with a leadoff home run from Chase Mydroth, who I adore. And in the 9th inning, they had the first home run from Munetaka Murakami, which was encouraging. However, if you're going to strike out 20 times in the first game of the season, you are going to end up in bad, no matter how nasty Jacob Mizorowski is. The fact that Munetaka Murakami, we spend months saying, this guy's going to strike out too much, did not strike out in this game, is kind of amazing. And that happening makes me feel like that 20 strikeouts is like an invisible wall that no one will ever cross over.
I know.
Because
it's great.
This was the chance to strike out more than 20 times if everybody else strikes out 20 times and Murakami's in the lineup. But no, he drew a couple walks against the Miz, grounded out, hit a home run. Shouts out to Mooney. That was very impressive. However, the rest of the White Sox, striking out 20 times is very bad. I love this post from Allie on Twitter. She's a White Sox fan who's very prominent on White Sox Twitter. She tweeted, my dad cursing at the TV means White Sox baseball is so back. I believe she posted that in like the second inning. She then followed up with a photo of her dad face first on the ground. Again, it's only like the third inning. It's only like 4-1 at this point. But this is what the White Sox do to people. Of course, it would go on to be, 14-2? But
it's also like we got to have
folks, we still bad.
We can't be prone on the ground on opening day for a team that is projected to win 66 games. Like, is it disappointing? Yeah, but we got to lower
it's
our
so
bar.
Great.
It's, you got
it's,
the Pope.
Honestly, it's also good, right? The Pope's giving him thumbs up before. That was funny. Someone saw the Pope recently and said, God bless the White Sox. And the Pope was like, yeah.
Hey,
Hopefully the Pope didn't watch yesterday's game.
I'm headed on vacation to Italy in May. Mm. Now, okay. I'm not going to Rome. Not going to Rome. If I do run into the Pope, what White Sox related thing should I scream towards the Pope? Email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Jermaine Dye? Should I just scream Jermaine Dye? Should I, like, what is the funniest White Sox thing to say to the Pope? Hey, Pope, do you know that Luis Angel Acuña is a switch hitter? Not.
I do think the best chance to get his attention is probably something like an older White Sox reference, as opposed to whoever's batting sixth for them by the time you're on vacation, right? I mean, that is funnier from our perspective, but in terms of like getting his attention, screaming, you know, Sam Antonacci different because he's Team Italy. I mean, that's a collab maybe we will see at some point, right? the Antonacci, Kyle Teal. Pope collab. Okay, let's go to you have bad and then ugly.
I got one more bad. This is a headline at The Athletic written by Spencer Nussbaum. Oh, hell yeah. Frustrated Nationals fans find themselves shut out of watching an opening day on TV. I'm not going to get into the whole television fiasco that MLB has had to wade through, some of which is their own doing, some of which is not. The upshot here is that the Nationals, and I think Mariners fans had similar issues. Jordan, you would know better than me. Finding where to watch the game, and I'm just going to read this graph. Fans of some of these teams didn't find out where to watch games until Thursday morning, just a few hours before first pitch. Why? Money! MLB was in negotiations until the last minute with various distributors to carry the games. Those talks went down to the wire as the league and the TV providers tried to maximize their income. But even once the channel announcement was made, some fans who were able to watch Nats games last season were told by customer service agents that the games now required a more expensive package. MLB, figure out how to have people watch the baseball games. That's it, dude. It's not that complicated. People want to give their money. The fans are like, please take my money. Take their money. Make this simpler. I know that this is just a 3-year thing until you get all the rights figured out at one time and it'll all be Shangri-La, but this is unacceptable, dude. This sucks, okay? People want to pay you money to watch the 2026 Nats. Get it sorted.
Your product is as good as ever. People want to watch it. People want to consume it. And you are making it more difficult, which is a good transition to UGLA. How about you begin with whatever happened on Wednesday night on Netflix, where baseball was played and stuff happened around it. I'll be honest, I didn't watch. I actually watched a lot of the pregame. I wanted to see what Barry Bonds was going to say, and he did say some interesting stuff. However, the baseball game, now it's not Netflix's fault that Logan Webb got crushed and the game wasn't very good. However, there was definitely some ugly, some bad, some good around the broadcast.
I was going to say, I'm just going to good, bad, ugly the experience. The good. There were moments and shots and camera angles that looked unbelievable. Like, there was a cinematic element to this that I think we expected, similar to maybe what we've seen in Apple TV broadcasts, where it's like, if Netflix is going to do a baseball game, they're going to make it look like entertainment. And that's another good thing that I did like about it, is that they're trying something different. I give them credit for that. That's okay. The bad is, one, missing the ABS thing was unacceptable. And the score bug was unreadable. Bert Kreischer was for nobody. No Bert Kreischer fan, okay, is buying a Netflix package to watch him jump about this game when they can watch 80 million YouTube shorts of him on the computer at any time. He was only there to promote a television program that he has on Netflix. And so Netflix didn't seem to understand whether this was like a baseball game or a billboard. And so for that reason, it is ugly, it is bad, and I don't know what to think about their involvement moving forward.
Yeah, their only other broadcast this season will be the Home Run Derby and the Field of Dreams game, so we will see how those go. But it's weird because, right, if you're trying to accomplish credibility in the broadcasting sports space, it doesn't seem like they did a great job there. Experimenting with certain elements of a baseball broadcast, we're all for. Sounds like the execution and some of the personalities involved were maybe not the best. My first ugly will also be Giants related, which is that the streak is over, folks. Last year, Elliot Ramos became the first ever right-handed hitter to hit a ball into McCovey Cove. And now Elliot Ramos, who I also thought was going to be the first Giants hitter to hit 30 home runs since Barry Bonds, but Willie Adames took care of that fun fact. However, Ramos does end this streak, which is the famous Barry Bonds left field curse. Since Barry Bonds retired in 2007, the Giants have had a different starting left fielder on opening day every single season. The longest such streak of different starters on opening day at a certain position in Major League history. However, it is over. Elliot Ramos has now done it. He has started on opening
this
day in the same position in consecutive years.
Includes Dave Roberts. That's how long this has been going.
And Mark DeRosa. And Mark DeRosa's on there. It's an incredible list of players that most of them have been. Some of them have been very good players, right? Hunter Pence is in there. We got Jock Peterson in there. Shouts out Blake Sable, Fred Lewis. But yeah, this is it's over. It's over. However, there is another streak in progress, and that is the Guardians' right field, 15 years in a row different. But that one also might be in jeopardy because, as we mentioned earlier, Chase DeLauder is pretty damn good. Mm. And I would not be surprised if Chase DeLauder is back out there in right field on opening day next year. So we will see what the next streak is that we will track in this regard. I believe the White Sox right field streak is up to 9 years, but this is as ugly as it gets. And it is definitely a streak I will miss dearly because it was a kind of a comfort every opening day. It could be like, oh, who's playing left field for the Giants? Oh, it's Jarrett Parker. Of course. So we won't have that anymore. That's ugly.
All right, let's wrap things up with a couple of new home run celebrations.
Yes.
The Pirates and the Guardians had some fuego yesterday. The Pirates, who I critiqued for saying they would die for the city of Pittsburgh, the tone around their home run celebration is much more appropriate. They will be celebrating home runs with gear that they got from like local actual steel workers. They have like the steel, like a welding mask is what they use. They just throw it on whenever they hit a home run. This is great. Great way to kind of encapsulate what the city's about. That thing's got to be heavy and a schlep to travel with. So thoughts and prayers to the Pirates, you know, equipment people. And then the guards. It was even more ridiculous. The Guardians had a home run night helmet, like the type you'd see at like a Renaissance festival. And that's kind of where they got it. Medieval times. The Guardians went to medieval times in Scottsdale, Arizona as a team. And there are pictures of them. It seems like all the rookies were made to dress up as one group of knights and the vets were a different group of knights. And Austin Hedges, who is, you know, effectively a manager at this point for them, bought a knight's helmet and is using that as the home run celebration as a hat, a helmet tip to the club's time together at medieval times. No notes. Great job, Guardians. Stay weird.
Well done. Well done, Gardos. I look forward to seeing that knight helmet in person. And we will finish in the only place we possibly could with my Ugla. Finish this opening day episode, and that is the dead bird in right field at Citi Field.
Dead bird.
Carson Bench. They scooped it up. Things were weird. The dead bird next to Carson Bench. It's ugly. What more do you want me to say? I mean, I know you were there and I wasn't. Did you notice it from the press box?
Did I notice the two birds colliding in air? No. So did I notice the stoppage?
That's why.
Yeah, I think two birds collided and one went down. The thing is, when you're at Citi Field, you just have to ignore what's flying through the air because of the planes. So you don't really think about
it. It's a great point.
So yeah. I just noticed it once there was a stoppage. Carson Bench was hilarious after the game. They were like, apparently fans were yelling at him to pick it up. It's like, your guy just went yard. I guess he went yard after the bird. You have this hotshot rookie. You want him to get some sort of like avian flu from picking up a deceased pigeon? No. Bad Mets fans. You do not want Carson Bench handling this barehand.
You got the Gronsky. There's a lot of people in that building that should pick that bird up before Carson Benj. And that is what happened. And that is Ugla. We're done. We did it. All right. Guess we'll pack it in. We'll see you guys next season. Oh, wait a minute. We have to just keep doing this 3 times a week for the next 7 months. Sounds good to me. I'm having a good time. I look forward to podcasting again with you on Monday, my friend. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing this episode of Baseball Barbiecast. We're rolling, folks. This was a fun way to start the season. And to the six teams who haven't played yet, the A's, the Blue Jays, the Braves, the Royals, the Rockies, the Marlins, I guess we'll talk about you on Monday. But until then, you can email us at baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. Welcome back to Major League Baseball. And talk to you all soon. See you.